This is Line Break, where we deconstruct poetry written by young writers and discuss the inspiration and intention behind their poems. Take a pause and enjoy the Line Breaks. Here's episode 39, where I talk with Reese Rivers and Stone about her poem, Dreamsicle Belly Up. I hope you enjoy.
Hi, I'm Reese. My YWP username is Reese Rivers and Stone, and my poem is called Dreamsicle Belly Up. One, sticky syrup runs down my brother's left arm. Raspberry bush catches him by the ankle. We ignore the venom and crush her underfoot. Youth is sour orange in the moment, but vanilla cream forever. We're gods of crabapple, monarchs of sticks, yesterday's manure still hanging in the air as starlings squabble above red rubber kickball. One good boot, and it's over the stars toward Carolina. Sit down, hold hands, smile, don't pout. Pigtails, ponytails, paper crown, next round playground, and asphalt somersaults. Two. The movies that I was too cheap to buy popcorn for were wrong, but still flashy. Kaleidoscope spending sight showed us to stay upright with splintering shins and pallid pride, trade wishes for weightless and identity for eye candy. My equations fester in graphite, new sneakers worn thin, another night devoured by harsh blue machines. My record's nearly clean, my arc's invisible. Nostalgia dies in the bud when you only live for the future. Head down, pen in hand, know it, don't guess. Ink drips, flushed lips, faux elite, stolen sweets, track meets, and asphalt somersaults. Three. Obliterate your old world for a shot at the blinding white new. You only miss the subtle things, shoulder touches and the smell of earth. You need to narrow down your multitudes to have a clue what's next. Some kind of boxed in, starry-eyed Schrodinger's human. Windy City, sweep me into your storm drains. Let the low, dark sound of uncertainty dissolve in the cloaking fanfare of lunch rushes. Sickle fluidly from skyscraper to pavement and back again. Downtown, fireborn, start anew, don't wait. City, sea, home free, ice dreams, skies freeze, gravel sneeze, and asphalt somersaults.
Oh, thank you so much. This is one of my favorite poems that we've done on Line Break, so I'm so excited to start
talking
about it.
Thank you, that's so sweet.
So what was your inspiration for the title and for the whole piece?
So I actually got this as like an assignment for English. It was a very broad poetry assignment. I'm heading off to college next year, and I was really like reflecting on, in some ways, I really want to become a new person, but I also like, I don't really know how to say goodbye. I don't really know how to deal with the nostalgia that I have for things that never really happened, and how to deal with all like the fantasies that I had in my teenage years that will never come to fruition, like once I head off to college. And so I wrote this to sort of explore like both like what actually happened in my life and sort of this lens of memory, this lens of living for the future, living for fantasy, and how that is sort of going to follow me when I move to Chicago this fall to go to college.
I can so relate to that, especially like the feeling of nostalgia for things that never happened. Yeah. I feel like I turned 16 a few weeks before the pandemic and like the lockdown began in February of last year. And I feel like I've read all these books and watched all these movies where it's like when you're 16, that's the best year of your life. Like that's when everything happens. These are like your prime years. And I feel like that's so made up that like 16 to 18 is like the best time of your life. I had all these like expectations that like I'm gonna have my own car, I'm gonna drive myself places with my friends, I'm gonna go to parties, I'm gonna do this, and like none of those things happened, and I still feel like it's bittersweet, and I'm like mourning this part of my life that like I wanted to happen but it never really happened. And now I'm like 17 and I feel like my prime time is ending, and like I'm running out of time to do all these things that like I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I know. I'm turning 18 in September, and like I feel like that number, it just shuts the door. especially because it coincides with starting college for me.
And I feel like your poem addresses this in a really beautiful way and like really subtle too. And it's not like growing up is weird, but it's like missing your childhood and knowing that like once you become an adult and you start college and you like start living on your own, like you're expected to be all these things and like get everything right on your first try and not have to guess or do things again and to like really know who you are.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part. I think it's knowing who you are, because making mistakes, you're like, oh, I mean, it feels bad, but everybody does it. But if I'm doing something that I did when I thought I was a different person, that feels like more wrong to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that whole thing that like kids will be kids, you know, just let them go through their phases. But no one ever says that when you're adult, like, oh, it's just a phase.
It's just a phase.
You can't get away with that once you're 18. It's like, no, you're going to be an adult. That's my rant for now. But back to your poem. What was the first line that you thought of and how did you go from there?
The first line that I thought of was pigtails, ponytails, paper crown, next round, playground. I really began this poem focusing on the images. I'm someone who, like, when it comes to like poetry, when it comes to writing, I like concepts that really interconnect. And I also like words that sound nice in your mouth, like the prosody is the fancy word for it. The rhyme and the meter and the feel of it. And so I was essentially just playing word association in my head. I was like, all right, pigtails, ponytails, paper crown, next round, playground. How do I get from pigtails to playground, staying on the same subject? And then I was creating all these images in my head, and I realized I kept coming back to like the sense of like earth, the sense of pavement, the sense of asphalt somersaults. And I was like, okay. So I have something here, this idea of you always come back down to the ground again. And combining that with like my sort of experience of moving through the phases of my life and reflecting on them, I was like, how do I explore this in different contexts? How do I explore this in different contexts? And how do I use the imagery that defined these periods of my life?
Yeah, that was one of the other things I was going to mention, is how vivid the images are and how like they flow together so nicely, even though they're different, but they're all like connected in a way. I've said this a lot before, but it reminds me of those mind maps. Have you seen those where like you start with one word and then you branch out to other words and ideas?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was doing. I was just doing straight up word association. I was just like, yeah, I think that's a good way to.
Sometimes that's the best kind of writing, you know, where like you just see where your thoughts take you and you don't limit yourself to one particular kind of subject or, I don't know, concept. So another question, when did you feel like you had reached a turning point in this piece, or like you had finally captured what you had been imagining and working on?
I, like at the beginning, I sort of had these sort of like disconnected images. I like knew I wanted to put them together somehow, and I knew what like my main theme was, you know, like growing up in nostalgia and the nature of time and whatever. And I started thinking about some of the other stuff we'd read in my English class. And one of the books we read is a book called The God of Small Things. I think the author's name is Arundhati Roy. And so this is it's a really fascinating book. It's really, really vibrant. And it has this imagery that is like on one hand, like sweet and delirious, and it's just colorful and it draws you in, and it contrasts like one, and then like 1 second later, like contrasts with something like disgusting or like bodily or like something, you know, something that you wouldn't normally notice if you were describing a scene. Her book is from the perspective of a child, and it uses this lens of just noticing the most striking, the most colorful, the strongest imagery that evokes feeling, whether it's good or bad or funny or weird. And I thought that sort of going through that child lens would be a really good way to express that nostalgia in a way that didn't seem like as far away as it is to me now. And then from there, I tried to apply, like I did the child lens, then I did the teenager lens, and then I did the daydreamy looking towards the future lens. That was sort of my thought process there.
Mm-hmm. So there are so many lines in here that I wish I had written, especially one of the first lines in the first stanza. Use sour orange in the moment, but vanilla cream forever. What was your inspiration for that?
I think I actually got the title of this first. I was thinking about a specific moment. I was thinking about sitting in front of the country store in like our little Vermont town on just some hot day where like we'd been at the community garden. And I just remember like watching my brother just like spill a creamsicle down his front. And it was such a small moment, but I just really remembered it. And it just felt like a really good encapsulation of like the idyllic summer day for a child, you know, like going to the garden, playing in a river, sitting in the country store and melting ice cream all over yourself. And then like the title is Dreamsicle Belly Up. It was originally Creamsicle, but then I remember that Dreamsicle was a brand of creamsicle and that connects to everything. And that line is just, you know, I mean, what it means to me anyway is that, you know, in the moment youth is, it's colorful and it's vibrant, and sometimes it's, you know, it's volatile. It makes you feel euphoric one moment and you're, you know, crying about your dropped ice cream the next. And then once you get older and it's nostalgic, it's just, it's smooth and it's white and it's vanilla cream.
Yeah, I just loved how you took this imagery of a creamsicle and kind of like worked with it in this really like natural way. It doesn't feel forced, but I can relate to that. And I see that in my own life, where like these memories that I have of, you know, bad experiences, I don't remember them. I only remember like the moments right before or right after when I'm happy, you know, like when I'm looking back on my childhood, I don't think of like all these times that I fell down and scraped my knees. All I think of is when I got a princess Band-Aid and I really loved it. And yeah. I put princess Band-Aids all over my arms because I thought it was cool. Like, that's what I remember. I don't remember like the bad part. So I understand. And like, I really like how you use that metaphor.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful image of a girl with princess Band-Aids up and down.
There are so many pictures of me with Band-Aids just like all over myself because I thought they were kind of like stickers. And I put them on exactly. All of my dolls, all of my stuffed animals. I had like a real Band-Aid obsession.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And something that I'm really interested in is neuroscience. It's like the way our brain perceives reality. And so like one thing that I was really thinking about in terms of like nostalgia and stuff is that our brain has this like really strong positivity bias. You know, we need hope to keep us going. So our memories are rosy, but also like our perception of the future is better than what it's actually going to be. I remember like one study that I read that really left an impact on me is they asked people a bunch of questions about what they thought was going to happen in the next like couple months of their life. A variety of questions like, you know, social life, job, stuff like that. And about 2/3 of the responses, people expected something positive to happen when in reality, good and bad is half and half. And when they came back, it was good and bad, half and half. And we just have that lens of positivity, which in some ways is really sad because we can never see the world as it is. But in other ways, it like makes the world so much more beautiful and it gives us so much more hope. And it's just one of my favorite paradoxes.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful thing. Perfect to write about too. I feel like that's a really childlike thing too, that we still have. We're like, when you're a kid, you know, you don't think about getting into a car accident, or you don't think about what if I get lost in this big store and I can't find my parents. You're never really thinking about that. You're always thinking about the good thing instead. And I feel like that's definitely something that we all do. I would probably do that too if I thought about the next few years of my life. I'd be like, well, graduate with honors. I'm going to I'm going to do this and do that. And I'm not going to be like, well, I'm not going to be able to get the car that I want. I'm not going to be able to afford a car, you know? Yeah. I'm not going to tell myself that. I'm going to instead dream of like getting the quirky dark green vulva that I want, you know.
Ooh, dark green. You can blend in to the forest.
Yeah, camouflage. All these expectations and kind of ideas of what's going to happen, even though it's not realistic at all, but I'm never going to tell myself, well, maybe occasionally I'll tell myself this is going to all go wrong, but I'm not going to predict my future in like this disastrous way.
Exactly.
But neuroscience is so cool to me too. And like memories are such an interesting thing. I read a memoir by Amy Tan, Where the Past Begins, I think that's what it's called. And she's such a good writer. And it was about memory and like all these different memories of her family and her mother. And like, it's intense at times, but it's just amazing. I had like chills at the end. It was so cool.
Where the Past Begins. That sounds really cool. I love the books that are just fragmented memories that kind of blend together. The book I mentioned earlier, God of Small Things, is kind of like that too. I love that. It's so immersive.
Yeah. And one of the moments in her book that really struck me was when she was talking about how she was at a writer's conference and they were doing different writing exercises, and the instructor was saying like, think of a time when you thought you were going to die. And the first thing that she thought of was when she was in a car accident. And then he was like, okay, but when did you think you were really going to die? And then she thought of when she had like gotten a bad injury or fallen off some cliff or something. I can't remember. And then he was like, okay, but keep going. And then this memory came to her suddenly, and she had like buried it for years. And she was like crying, and she was like, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot about this. That was just so cool to me that like, through the process of writing, you can discover all these things about yourself that like your mind had kind of hidden from you. And like that relationship, like you're talking about, you know, between your brain and writing and memory, like, that whole intersection is so cool to me. And I feel like her memoir really does a good job of addressing it.
Yeah, that's something that can really happen when you're writing. It's just your associations become so free. It's like your brain turns to soup. There's no like discrete areas like this one's memory and this one's vision. It's all just so interconnected. There's the lie that you only use 10% of your brain. You use 100% of your brain all the time, because it's both the connections that you are making and the connections that you're not making, you know?
Yeah. So some more lines. Gods of crabapple, monarchs of sticks, yesterday's manure is still hanging in the air. A starling's squabble over a red rubber kickball. One good boot and it's over the stars toward Carolina. This stanza flows so well and it has a really nice rhythm. And I get a strong sense of this like carefree feeling of kids and just like running wild, you know?
Yeah, I also put this one together through three different images, like all relating to like my elementary school. I mean, I think being about like 8-9 years old was when I felt the most powerful, because I felt like, you know, you own your crabapple tree, you own your corner of the playground, you have your faction, you have your allies. You can do anything. And if somebody takes your kickball, you can just startle over again tomorrow. It's like cartoon logic, but with like alliances, and it just feels so much more, it feels so heightened, but it doesn't actually matter. So there's no real feelings hurt. And then the last line, one good boot and it's over the stars toward Carolina. I just remember a specific day when this one kid kicked the kickball over the entire school, and like we just worshipped him for the rest of the school day. And we're like, how did you do that? Like the kid who was good at soccer, and the rest of us were just like, and then Carolina, I've never been to North, well, this refers to South Carolina. I have never been there. But I always saw these ads for Myrtle Beach on the TV as a kid, and it just seemed like paradise to me. I wasn't as interested in like Disneyland, because like I only watched PBS growing up. But like Myrtle Beach just seemed like heaven for a child. And like it's the kind of place where like you hit your kickball, it goes over the stars because anything could happen, and it lands in Carolina, the paradise for kids that I never actually got to see.
Oh, that's so cool. I love how you described that. I can definitely relate to like one kid doing something kind of like not amazing, but like a little bit lame. But like in my child mind, it was like incredible. Like when I was 8, again, I was like, I thought I was so incredible when I was 8. I had all these crushes. I was convinced they loved me. I was a fashionista. I painted my nails every day. I had hair extensions and like makeup and stuff. I was so cool when I was 8. But I had this crush on this boy who lived in my neighborhood. His apartment was like a floor down from mine, and so we hung out together all the time with his cousin who lived in the same building. And we went to the playground, and one day he jumped from the turret because there's this like turret kind of slide in the playground. If you've ever seen this, I don't know how to describe it. Like a cone. He jumped from the top part of it to the ground and he broke his elbow, but I thought it was the coolest thing that's ever happened. And so for years, I wanted a cast. I wanted one that I could sign, that my friends could sign. I wanted to fall and break my elbow and just like, I don't know why, but to me, there was something so like reckless, but so cool about it too. Like, I wouldn't have ever jumped from someplace that tall, but it was just incredible in my mind. And I just love how confident I was when I was that young. Like, I was so sure of everything. Of course, my friends love me. Of course, my crush likes me. Of course, we're gonna date. Of course, I'm beautiful in my dress. And I wasn't ever like second guessing myself, which I feel like I wish I had that same confidence now.
Yeah, the empowerment of childhood. And I totally relate to just being jealous of people who hurt themselves. If they hurt themselves in an interesting way, I was like, how do I do that?
Yeah, I don't know why, but that was my friend Junior, and he was 12 when I was 8, and I had the biggest crush on him. I thought he was the coolest person I've ever met. And like looking back at it now, I'm like, oh, there's so much wrong with like that whole situation. But I don't know. I thought that I had the most like, I guess, aesthetic childhood in my mind.
I think we all did.
All right, back to your poem.
Yeah.
I love how the poem is separated into each section and how each section ends with asphalt somersaults. And I was wondering why that was the only line that's repeated and like the importance of it.
I think what it really means for me is the continuous process that we go through in our lives, where we fall and we have to pick ourselves up again. And sometimes it feels like we're always picking ourselves up again, and we never get past zero because we're just falling and we have to get up off of the ground again. But it mean what I really liked about it is that it means something different in each of the three sections. Because I mean, you're a kid, it's an asphalt somersault, it's fun, it's got that danger, and you're so confident that, like, skin your knee doesn't matter because you did a somersault. It's exciting. It's no big deal, you just get back up again, you're indestructible. And then the second stanza, that last, I kind of call it like the summary, the ink drips, flush slips, foe leads, so and so track meets. You get back to the asphalt again, and that's really you keep falling and you feel like you can't even get past the baseline because you're always picking yourself up, and you think, am I going to have to do this forever? And then in the final section, I use the line, cycle fluidly from skyscraper to pavement and back again. And I think that's just coming to the understanding that, highs and lows are a natural part of life. It is a cycle. It is the cycle of nature. It is the cycle of is the water. It's the cycle of water. It's the cycle of emotions. It's the cycle of, the events of your life. And you are going to fall. You do have to pick yourself up again, but you can understand that, it's a momentary thing.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And it's something that happens throughout our lives that we're always going to have those lows and those terrible moments, but then get back up. And then once we're up, we're going to go back down. You can't ever just stay in one place forever. So I think it was really beautiful. And I feel like I have Once I read that line, asphalt and somersaults, I thought to myself, like, oh my gosh, this reminds me of all the times that I fell down from my bike when I was a kid and I landed on the asphalt. And like, I remembered what it looked like up close when I was like all curled up in a ball after I fell off my bike. And like all those times I did hopscotch on the asphalt and soccer and street hockey and like all those little kid things. And I feel like when I was a kid, I was always on the asphalt, where I had like so many memories associated with it. And I didn't even realize it until I read this poem. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, pavement is surprisingly important for children.
Yeah. And then once you get to be a teenager, you have the whole thing with driving and learning how to drive on the pavement and you know, all those things. So some more lines. Another night devoured by harsh blue machines. Nostalgia dies in the bud when you only live for the future. Inspiration for those?
Harsh blue machines are computers. You know, it's just the cycle of I want to be successful. I want to get to the place I dreamed of, like academically, like career wise. I want people to respect me, and in order to do that, I need to, you know, make the things that are important to my basic needs not priorities anymore. Like, I need to make like part, my social life is less important than doing well at my track meet. It's less, you know, getting sleep is less important than getting a good grade on my test the next day. And then, yeah, the idea, nostalgia dies in the bud when you only live for the future. I use in the bud to sort of call back to the more like nature-y imagery of the first part. But, you know, if you never stopped to look around you and to enjoy what you actually had, and you only lived for your perfect idea of the future, then what will you even have to look back on?
Wow, I think that's a really powerful thing that we always forget to do, you know? I get so caught up in, like, my honor society and my student council and my grades and my five classes and my 4.0 GPA and, like, all these things, these things that stress me out. And I'm like, I've got to just keep going and get perfect and like be this amazing idealized version of myself. And I can't ever just sit down and like watch a YouTube video, you know? For the past 3 months, I had like a really busy semester doing all these different things and never really taking time for myself because I didn't feel like I could. I felt like that was selfish and unnecessary. Yeah. And like, God, what kind of person would I be if I took a day to myself instead of doing my homework and getting it submitted 2 days ahead of time? I had like all these really stressful and unrealistic expectations for myself that I feel like really came on to me as a teenager. But now I'm on break for another week and then I start as a TA for a class. But I'm just trying to focus on like relaxing. And even though I'm like, why am I sitting in bed all day watching YouTube videos? I'm like, you know what? I haven't been able to do that for so long, so why not give myself the chance to now and hang out with my friends and talk to them on the phone and go places with my family and bake things and hang out with my younger brother finally and like do all these things that I had been putting off for so long. Because like you said, you know, when I'm older, I don't want to look back at this time in my life and be like, what did I do besides stare at Word documents on my computer for hours, you know? Because like I lose myself in all this homework and then I never resurface to like be a person.
Yeah, that's a really elegant way to put that. Yeah.
Well, this is my big long rant. I feel like this poem just raises so much for me to rant about. But some more lines, head down, pen in hand, know it, don't guess. I so relate to this. We talked about it before, but like having to know what you want and who you are and what you need immediately when you're a teenager. Yeah. And that whole like take your SATs, take your Accuplacer tests and like do this and do that and know all the answers and don't ask for help. I mean, maybe that's just my perception, but I feel like once I'm an adult, I can't really ask for help.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand that. And it's just like this idea that like sort of trying to make your own path through high school was not what you're supposed to do. This idea that, oh, like, for example, like if you're really sports focused, you need to figure out what all the great athletes did in high school. Or if you're like me and you're really school focused, you need to figure out what all the kids in the prep schools in New York City are doing to get into college, or you can't do it. You can't do it. You have to go research. You have to go stress about every little thing. And I mean, eventually I mostly got over that, but it's always there, you know?
Yeah, that like constant kind of nagging from yourself and your mind, which brings me to another line that really hit me. I felt this. I was like, ooh, that's me, which is you need to narrow down your multitudes to know what's next. And I was like, oh my gosh, that hit me. Like applying to college and thinking about what career I want to have and who I want to be. It's like I've got all these different people that I am and these different things I'm interested in, but I kind of have to choose at some point and I have to narrow it down into a feasible future and not just like my childhood dream of being a ballerina / boutique owner / makeup artist / astronaut, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's just the idea that like even if I end up being a scientist like I always wanted to be since I was a kid, like I have to pick one area of science and I have to study it. And I mean, I know you don't have to study the same field of science for the rest of your life, but I feel like I do. And then I will have to like let go of everything else I'm so interested in. And I mean, I referenced like Schrodinger's cat, Schrodinger's thought experiment here, which is just the idea that like all the fundamental particles of the universe like exist in superposition, which means they exist as a probability. They exist one half, like 50% over here and 50% over there. And you don't actually know until you open the box and look at it, look to see whether the cat is alive or dead, or you like put down your microscope and you see, oh, it's on this side. And like, I kind of feel like that. I feel like I'm in superposition. I feel like there's so many different people that I could be, and that, you know, making choices is just cutting the branch off of so many different futures. And I mean, of course it is, but also like you don't have a choice. And also, you know, you're also realizing one of those possible futures.
Yeah, I just learned about that thought experiment. I wrote about it for my science and spirituality class in my final, but we also had some discussions about it. But I thought it was really cool, you know, the idea that this thing, whether it's like a hypothetical cat or like your future, whatever, it's both existing and not existing until you actually take the moment to like open the box metaphorically or like take time to think about it. And then you find the answer to it. And I just think it's really cool that like thinking about, you know, this duality in these two different versions of yourself that exist and like, you know, that whole idea of like in some other life, you know, like different lives you can live if you make this one decision. And I feel like that's why being a teenager seems so momentous to me. And that's why I write so much about it, is because I feel like all these different decisions can lead me to living such different lives.
Yeah, I agree too. And I really like that idea of duality, of, you know, things not being black and white, of like two interpretations maybe existing at the same time. Maybe even if they don't physically exist, they spiritually exist, you know, they exist as a spectrum, not as a, you know, as a binary.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, important too, is that like, you don't have to be one or the other. Sometimes you can be everything.
Sometimes you can be everything.
So you're ending. City, sea, home free, ice streams, skies freeze, gravel sneeze, and asphalt somersaults.
This last stanza and then the last couple of lines are about the city of Chicago. I'm going to the University of Chicago in the fall. And so I have a couple references to the city itself. I mean, Windy City, obviously that's a nickname. And then like downtown Fireborn, the Great Chicago Fire, that's a really central like concept to Chicagoans. Like this idea that you can keep rebuilding yourself. You can start anew a million times. You're not stuck by like The Ideas of the Past, and then City C, Home Free. I mean, Chicago is right on Lake Michigan, which is this massive lake. It looks like it's an ocean. The only lake I'm really used to is Lake Champlain, which is it's a great lake. It's very big, but you can see right across it. You know, it just, and New York's on the other side, but in Chicago, it just stretches forever. And then Ice Dreams is just sort of Ice Dreams, Skies Freeze. I mean, it gets pretty cold, but also a callback to Dreamsicle. And then Skies Freeze, Gravel Sneeze, and Asphalt Somersaults. Just that idea of, you know, you're going to fall, you're going to get cold, but you got to pick yourself up again, because it's just a natural part of life.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this poem. I love talking about it. I love this poem so much, because I feel like it speaks to me so much, like where I am right now in my life and my childhood and all these different parts of me. So thank you. And moving on to some other questions, how did you first become interested in writing?
So I've had an interesting relationship with writing, actually. I was always way more into reading. I would try to read books that I did not know the words to. At 9 years old, I would try to like make it through my mom's books, and like I didn't know half the words, so I would try to infer them. And then I learned all these words with like the wrong meanings, because I like inferred them in the context of like one specific book. And then I can never pronounce any complicated word, because I've only seen it in books. It's a problem. I read so much as a kid, which I think was probably really instrumental to developing most of my writing skills, most of my analytical skills. But I had a hard time with writing when I was like in middle school, because I just felt like it had to be perfect, and I wasn't putting my ideas on paper the way I felt that I should. Poetry is something I've just been sort of putting on paper for a while. And poetry, like, it feels like a way to write without making too much of a commitment, you know? It feels like a way to just sort of like express a pure emotion, put together some words that sound nice together, and try to like take these ideas that I'm experiencing in my life and put a spin on them. And it doesn't have to be linear. It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to like have meaning for anybody else but me. And that really was sort of my first introduction to like really loving writing. And then as I, you know, got through high school, and I started to learn, you just got to put it down on the paper. You just got to get it out there. It doesn't really matter if it's bad, especially since like sometimes you start writing and it's just like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And then you just get there and you're like, how did I do that? that's just a summary of my writing journey, I guess.
Oh, I think that reading is so important in becoming a writer, and like, you know, expanding on your writing, and not just like becoming interested in it, but like sustaining your interest and like still getting inspiration after you've been writing for years. And I remember, you know, being younger too and reading books that were way too advanced for me.
Yeah.
There's a picture of me and my brother when I was 2 and he was like 10 or 11. And we were both holding these books that were like chapter books, and I had on pink sunglasses, and I was just like casually flipping through this chapter book, yeah, pretending that I was reading it just as easily as he was. And like, it's just so funny to me that I've always wanted to read things, and I've never really told myself that that's too smart for me, or like that's I shouldn't read that. I have a book obsession now. I have way too many books, but I feel like they've definitely shaped me, and there's so much that I get from books and so many memories that I have associated with books, which brings me to my next two questions.
All right.
What books?
Nice segue.
What books and authors have shaped you as a writer and human being?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I've definitely, I think most recently I've been reading a lot of Oliver Sacks, who is this neuroscientist doctor who writes about like the things we experience, but in more like more, it's like neuroscience, but in more metaphorical terms. So he has a book on hallucinations that I really loved, a book on musicophilia, which is like the way our brain interacts with music. And then there's one about called Awakenings that's about, it's about Parkinson's and the experiences of those patients. And it's sort of like looking through the eyes of other people, learning through like the bizarre, strange experiences of other people, what do we learn about these things that we all experience? And I think that's been, I think just that idea of the idea of perspective and like these themes of like memory and all of the cool stuff that happens in our brain has definitely influenced the things I write. I think, yeah, my writing is fairly sciencey because I really like sort of incorporating these like, you know, an analytical, somewhat straightforward ideas and being like, no, this isn't just like learning things, like writing down notes. Like there's so many like messy contradictions within science and we can really learn about them because they really define us. In terms of other authors that I've read, I'm like looking at my bookshelf now. I mean, like my favorite book series as a kid was definitely like Percy Jackson. I just love how creative it was, how it like brought like these old traditions into the modern world and just created these like these personas that were just so empathetic with other, like so such like an empathetic portrayal of like young teenagers that I really felt that spoke to me. I have such a bad memory for books. But one that I read recently that's like sort of like a modern classic or whatever is The Handmaid's Tale. I absolutely I didn't think I was going to love it so much. Oh, it's so good.
I'm such a Margaret Atwood fangirl.
I read some Margaret Atwood before, but like it's an incredible book, and it just like it portrays like the inner life of the protagonist so well, while also just being such a like a harsh social criticism.
It's so harsh and so like grimy at times, but it's so beautiful, and like there's so many parts that I just loved. And also I'm reading Cat's Eye, which is another one of her books, I think one of her first books that came out in the 80s, but I started reading it a couple of months ago. I still haven't finished it because I keep forgetting to, but it's really beautiful too. And like her descriptions of, you know, being a child and these girls that are 8 and like their really intense drama and like trying to be someone else for your friends. Like it's intense too, but I love how she writes about it. And
yeah,
I remember in the first chapter or one of the first chapters, she talks about how time is like water running from a faucet and stuff, and how yeah, like it's all meshes together. And it's like, oh, I just love her writing so much. What are 3 books on your to be read list for the summer?
Well, I definitely want to read more Margaret Atwood now that I've read some of her work. So I'm definitely going to read a couple books by her. I think I want to go back and sort of like read some of the classics this summer. So I was thinking things like, I read The Great Gatsby. Like I read it first in 9th grade and I like didn't really get it. And I want to reread it again because it has a lot of really interesting symbolism in it. And I want to check that out. There's also a couple of neuroscience books I want to read. One specific one is, it's called Live Wired. In my neuroscience group thing that I like work for, we had this guy called David Eagleman come in, and he has a book called Live Wired, and it's about neuroplasticity. So it's about our ability to reshape our brains. And I think it's really fascinating.
I wrote 2 different papers about that.
Yeah, neuroplasticity is amazing. It's one of my favorite things in neuroscience. It's just so many possibilities.
I wrote 2 different papers about neuroplasticity, and I was really obsessed with it. And also, to drop a very large word, psychoneuroimmunology. I wrote about that a little bit too, because it sounds like a really intimidating thing, but it's just the connection between your mind and your body, and how like your thoughts affect your physical health, which I thought was really interesting. But neuroplasticity, like how you can change mood and your mental health through your physical thoughts and like thinking positively about yourself and others, is such a cool thing to me, because I feel like a lot of times when we're thinking negatively about ourselves, it really affects our mood. And the other day I was thinking to myself, like, wow, I'm having a really good day, I'm in a good mood today. And I was like, you know what, that's because I'm really happy, I'm like thinking positive thoughts about myself, and I'm thinking like, my skin looks great today and my hair looks great today. And you know, I'm not like, oh, my hair's so greasy, I need to wash it, you know. Like, I'm having all this positive stuff in my mind, and that's affecting my mood.
Yeah, the other thing is like the way that learning a skill can like really connect disparate areas of your brain. You know how they say how like playing a musical instrument will make you better at math? Because when it comes to your brain, like, yes, the different areas of your brain like broadly have different functions, but it's the connections that are the most important. I mean, the reason we can't replicate a human brain on a computer in like any scale is because we don't really understand all these feedback loops that are happening in our brain. And so understanding the connections is one of the most important frontiers of neuroscience, and but the fact that we can change those connections, we can connect certain parts of our brains to other parts of our brains just by learning a skill is absolutely incredible. And like, we can't necessarily like see these changes under a microscope. Like, yeah, if you learn a skill for like 20 years and you're super, super, super proficient in it, you'll see like a slight change in like density of your neurons. But just like learning another language, like, you can't see it, but it's doing so many things for your brain. And you can see it on a test. You can see it in the way that you use your first language, but it's not something we can really totally understand, but it's still such a powerful tool.
Yeah, for sure. I took piano lessons for 12 years, so I'm well into that whole music world, but I feel like a lot of the stuff that I learned in piano can be transferred to a lot of things that I do in other parts of my life. You know, for piano, I had all these like habits, and I had to like keep track of all these different things, and like memorization, that was a big thing. And so now I'm good at memorizing things, and
yeah,
I am good at looking at piano music, and I'm really good at sight reading, and I have really good ears, and I took a rock and roll class this past semester, which was so cool. And I was really good at picking out all the different instruments because of my music training. And, you know, it's cool how these things that I did when I was a kid are still like applicable to all these different parts of my life now. But music, I mean, piano was so cool because I got to the point, I don't even know when it was, but at some point it happened. And now, like, I haven't played piano in a couple of months because I've been busy, but I can look at a piano and instantly know, like, this white key is a C and this is an A. And like, I don't have to think to myself, where do I put my hand? You know, I just kind of figure it
exactly.
out.
Exactly. It's that muscle memory, that unconscious understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I play the saxophone, the alto saxophone. I love playing the saxophone. It's so fun. Like music and like poetry for me, I feel they're kind of the same animal. Yeah. Because I think they both have, like, for me anyway, the most important thing about them is to bring out an emotion, to tell a story, to not tell it directly, but to tell it through the nuances, to tell it through the crescendos, to tell it through the accents. And so I often think about poetry through musical terms, because I really learned the language of music first before I learned the language of poetry. And so when I'm reading poetry or writing poetry, I'll think about it in terms of crescendos. I'll think about it in terms of colors and notes and flourishes. And I feel like, and then I'll think about my music in terms of images. I'll think about it in terms of words that sound nice together, words that sound nice in my mouth, words that sound nice through my saxophone. And it, there's just like a connection there. And I think understanding both sides of it really helps me to get to the emotional core of a feeling of some sort of human experience, so that other people can absorb the expression that I'm trying to create.
Yeah, that's really cool. I really like how you take music and apply it to poetry. I think that's really interesting. And I remember when I used to do recitals, like six a year, just all these different recitals with judges and like all these things that I get so nervous about. And my teacher would always like tell me that, you know, you can worry about memorizing a piece for so long, but at some point you're gonna just know instinctively. I think that's a word, but like your muscles are gonna remember it, and you just sit at the piano and you just let your like muscles do it for you. You don't have to like physically think about it that much. And that always worried me, just like this blind faith in my muscles that like I've got memory and like my fingers can do this for me. But
yeah,
at some point it did work and I didn't have to like keep thinking about it. And I had a recital coming up and I went to a music store with my dad and my brother, and I sat down on a piano and I played my song through from beginning to end. And I was like, I've never done this before, and I did it pretty well. And exactly. It was funny because there is a guy playing guitar on the stool like a few chairs away from me, and he's like, oh, is that Chopin? And I was like, yes. But it was funny.
Love Chopin.
I just think it's so cool how you can like apply music to poetry and how there's a lot in common, and how music is kind of like the poetry of sounds in a way, where like you're trying to make it sound pretty and tell a story, and it's kind of abstract and it's not really like linear, and it's just really beautiful. So with all that being said, thank you so much for recording this podcast with me.
Of course. You really, you know, brought out the things that I wanted to say, and I think your questions were just really, really probing and wonderful. And I love the idea that music is the poetry of sound. So thank you so much.
Yes, thank you too. This has been episode 39 of Line Break. I hope you enjoyed, and stay tuned for episode 40. Bye.